We want to spend the remainder of our time looking at the subject of atheism. Atheism. Here are the four horsemen of the new atheism. The new atheism is distinct from old line atheism in that the new atheists not only say that Christians and Hindus and Muslims and Jews are wrong, but they say that Hindus and Christians and Muslims and Jews are actually evil for believing what they believe. The new atheism really hit the market after 9/11, where it was seen in a very public, traumatic way that not all religion is good. And the extremist Muslim religion of those terrorists who basically had taken their religion in order to kill, these new atheists jumped on that and said, that's really like all religion. That's like all Muslims. That's like all Christians. That's like all Jews. That's like all Hindus. And so the new atheists really hit the market at that time. And these would consist of Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, the late Christopher Hitchens. He passed away a couple years ago. And professor of philosophy, Daniel Dennett. And these have really become popularizers in the field of atheism. Let's do the etymology of this word. Where does this word come from? Again, the alpha privative is the negation. And the central word, atheism, is the word theos, God, theology, theos. And an ism is a worldview. And as we've argued before, this is not saying a theos in the sense of saying a moral. Like amoral means you're not moral. Like you don't believe in morality. Atheism isn't that you just lack belief in God. It is the positive assertion that you don't believe God exists. If you simply lack belief in God, what are you? You're not an atheist, you're an agnostic. Yeah. Agnostics are saying, beats me, I don't know, I lack belief in God. But an atheist is saying, no, there is no God. God does not exist. Besides, under that definition, that I just lack belief in God, therefore I'm an atheist, your cat could be defined as an atheist. Your newborn baby could be defined as an atheist. Your baby lacks belief in God. Your cat lacks belief in God. So if you were in a household with two dogs and three cats, you'd have five atheists living in your house. Clearly something's wrong with such a definition. Atheism means that you don't believe that God exists. Well, what are some of the more common objections of the new atheists? For one, they argued that theism, the concept of theism, is incoherent. And this is a good tack to take when you think about it. If you could show that the very concept of God is illogical, like it's inherently contradictory, like if you could show that God, with his attributes, is the same as a married bachelor, you could show with certainty that God doesn't exist. And that would be pretty nice, wouldn't it? The problem is no atheist has been able to show this, that God's attributes actually are illogical within himself. Now, they've tried. They've definitely tried. One example that you always get in the philosophy 101 class is that if God was all powerful, can he create a stone so heavy that even he can't move it? This is that kind of an objection. It's trying to show that the concept of God is illogical. To which we would reply, when you're asking that question, you're not asking for a stone. You're not asking for a 6 million ton stone. You're asking for God to do something illogical. But if he can do things which are illogical, then there is no such thing as logic, and therefore God's off the hook. So if you're going to ask, well, I can't believe in the logical coherency of God because God won't do something illogical, it's the atheist's objection that's actually illogical, not the concept of God. Another way of answering that is to hand the person a paperclip and say, hey, would you bend this into a square circle? And they're like, no. And you're like, what? You haven't been working out enough? You're not strong enough to do that? Haven't been hitting the weights, huh? Not on the creatine, protein, steroids. Man, you're getting really weak and flabby, aren't you? No, that's not the problem. Strength isn't the issue, that I can't bend the paperclip into a square circle. Logic is the issue. You're asking God to break logic. But that's the very thing you're arguing for, is that God is incoherent. So as it turns out, in each one of these cases, it isn't the concept of God that's incoherent, it's the objection which is incoherent. Well, we spend a whole night talking about that in quarter one, where we talk about the coherency of theism, what's called theology proper. So we shouldn't spend a lot of time on that, but it's something with which we should be prepared, where people are saying, how could you believe in an all-knowing God, and yet God has free will? Doesn't he know what he's going to do? And, I mean, you can throw out all these different examples of how it shows that God, his very nature isn't coherent, logical. Perhaps the number one objection from atheists is what is called the problem of evil. This goes back very ancient. This is something that's been debated for centuries, even millennia. And honestly, if I had to say, this is the hardest objection against theism, belief in God. How can you believe in a God who is all good, all powerful, all knowing, and yet evil exists? It's a very hard objection. When people were asked, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? They asked, why is there so much suffering in the world? It's the question of Job. I mean, it's the question all the way down throughout history. Why is God considered good and powerful and all-knowing, and yet there's evil? How do we answer this? There's a number of different ways, but I'd like to give you kind of a framework through which you could think about this. For one, we have to argue that the problem of evil isn't just a problem for Christians. The problem of evil is a problem for everyone. This is truly one of those problems that is difficult for every worldview to answer. Think of Eastern religion, for example, which is karmic law or divine retribution. The idea in karmic law is not that, well, I did a good deed, and so later that day, somebody gave me a free donut. Ah, what goes around comes around. It's not that that person was really mean, and then something bad happened to him. That's not karmic law. Karmic law is that you live a certain kind of life, moral or immoral or somewhere in between, and then when you die, you leave the body, you are reincarnated, put into another body, the transmigration of the soul, and depending on how you lived, you're put into either a human body or an animal body or an insect body. And from that, that is dispensing karmic justice. So in this life, it's one thing. You live out your life, and at the end of your life, you're judged, and then you're slotted into whatever new life. And then you can either climb or you can descend on the karmic ladder. Well, of course, this view is not a biblical idea. We need to say that right up front. The whole idea that there's such a thing as karmic law, we don't believe in karma. We believe in grace. That it's not that we live a certain life and we get what we deserve. In fact, Jesus got what we deserve, and he gave us what he deserves. And so we don't believe in this whole idea of karma. This is an anti-scientific view. When we go to regions of the world that were in extreme poverty, for example, or they were extremely diseased, under a karmic perspective, you would have to say, well, those people in previous lives were very immoral. And so with reincarnation and the transmigration of the soul, they were put into poverty, and they're put into disease, and they were born deformed, and that's the way that they are. And so it's a very anti-scientific view. Why? Because when we brought penicillin into these regions, we realized, oh, it wasn't karmic law. It was that they had some kind of a bacteria that was affecting them, and antibiotics cured it. Same thing is true with all of these different immunizations and modern medicine. It's not karmic law at all that they're deformed, that they're sick. It's that we can actually treat this. The person who is an adopter of karmic law would say, yes, but that's part of karma, that they're put into that life so that modern medicine would eventually bring them out of it to a large extent. Well, that's what they call an ad hoc explanation, and this, and this, and this. So it's not just an explanation, you have to keep adding onto it to make sense of it. It's also an incredibly self-righteous perspective. Because whatever slot in life I'm in, that must mean that I earned it. How? From a previous life. That previous life, basically, I was a good person, and that's why I'm living such a good life right now. Why are other people out there poor, destitute, diseased, dying? Well, it's because they lived a bad life. And so this is really a religion of self-righteousness, you could say. Here's a question to ask for this big view, I mean, which is very dominant in Eastern thought. What is the problem of evil under this view? Answer, there is no problem of evil. When a flood comes through and kills a bunch of women and kids, when a tornado hits a church on a Sunday, when there's a shooting, when there's no problem of evil there. You shouldn't weep any more than you should weep when a murderer gets thrown into prison. It's justice. It's not evil. There's nothing evil about it. They're getting their just deserts. They're getting what they deserve. And so under this view, what's the problem of evil? There is no problem. Number two, another major worldview is monism. Mono means one, and an ism is a worldview. So monism is that at its very essence of metaphysics, its very essence, reality, is one substance. So there's a form of monism which is naturalistic. The one substance is matter, or the one substance is energy. And then there's a whole nother form of monism, which is that the one substance is spirit. So you might say, but wait a minute, this table here, that sure feels physical, natural, matter, and energy. They would say, yeah, but that's an illusion. That's what they call Maya, an illusion. It's illusory, that you see a physical world, a natural world. It's not really there. The one substance at its base is spiritual. It's only an illusion that you're seeing a physical world of physical objects. Under this view, history is cyclical. Again, this is an Eastern perspective. Unlike the Bible, which has a linear view of time, and modern science, of course, think of Romans 13, where Paul says, today salvation is nearer than it was before. That's presupposing a linear view of time. Jesus uses the word palingenesia at the transfiguration of all things, the transformation of all things, Matthew 19:28. That word was used by Stoics to refer to a cyclical model where the universe would get burned up, and then that's the palingenesia, and then it would get recreated and then burned up and recreated and burned up and recreated. And Jesus says, no, not the palingenesias, the palingenesia. There's going to be one time where God comes in and judges, and then there's the new heavens and new earth. So history isn't cyclical, it's linear under the biblical view. But under a monistic view, many expressions of this, also called pantheistic, God is in everything, it's cyclical. It keeps happening over and over. Under this view, there is no help for those who are suffering. Why? Because suffering is an illusion. If everything is really one substance, which is spiritual, spirit, then if I'm having physical pain, physical suffering, deformity, disease, death, that's all illusory. The thought that I am a first-person viewer of the world, that I have consciousness, and that I can look out and look at the world, I have free will, that's an illusion. Under this view, Atman is Brahman. The idea that I'm a self that's separate from the world, that's an illusion. Think of the Beatles. I am you, and you are me, and he is she, and we are all together, however it goes. That was Eastern thinking. We're all together, we're all one, and this idea that we're separate entities is just an illusion. So someone who's suffering under this view, see, that's not real suffering. It's not real evil. And so under a monistic view, what's the problem of evil? There is no problem. Why? Because there is no evil. That's why. Evil doesn't exist on this view. We've imagined it away. What about naturalism? Or we could say atheism. These are two distinct ideologies, but naturalism is the positive affirmation that only nature exists, and atheism is the affirmation that God does not exist. But let's just blend them together for a second. Under naturalism, how do we define evil? Under naturalism, how do we defeat evil? And under naturalism, how do we deal with evil? First, how do we define evil? When a lion rips the throat out of an antelope, we don't call that evil. We call that nature. It's not moral or immoral. It's just natural. That's the way it is. In the natural order, Lions eat gazelles. Lions eat antelopes. Well, why is it different when one species, Homo sapiens, kills another Homo sapien? What's the difference? Not what's like the quantitative difference. Like, you know, gazelles have more body hair than Homo sapiens. Yeah. And we walk upright. And we have certain features that they don't. We have more neurons. We can work a remote control. You know, we can do these different things. Not the quantitative features, but what is the qualitative difference between the two? Why are we the ones that are somehow different from the rest of the natural order? Well, we've already gone through this. There is no difference under naturalism. Unless you believe in some kind of a transcendent standard outside of nature, you can't define what evil is because there's no foundation for it. Number two, how do you defeat evil? There used to be a string of authors during the Romantic era which wrote in a genre of literature referred to as utopian literature. This was the idea that the world was eventually going to get better and better. I mean, think of it. The 19th century, you had technology, you had medicine, you had coal burning for our ships, and you had international trade, you had the printing press, you had things moving in a direction. Not that many wars at the time, skirmishes, some wars, yes, but things were moving generally in a good direction, utopianism. Then the 20th century hit, and we had a new genre of literature referred to as the dystopian novel. Fahrenheit 451 by Bradbury, 1984 by Orwell, Brave New World by Huxley, and so on down the line, even down to juvenile fiction today, like The Hunger Games, or Divergent, or what's the other one I really hate? Maze Runner, yeah. Thomas felt sad. Thomas felt angry. Thomas was scared. It's like, what am I reading? Thomas the Train book here? Anyways, but they're all dystopian. Dystopian. That it's not going to be a good utopia. It's a negative utopia. Why? Because it was realized that even with all of our increase in technology and medicine and information and knowledge and communication, that's not our problem. Our problem is us. Our problem is human nature. And people started to realize we're never going to make it. We're never going to come together in world peace. Why? Because world peace with humans, there's a difficulty there. Humans are involved, and humans want to rip each other apart. So how do you defeat evil under this view? Now, the theistic worldview would have an answer to that, which we'll get to in a little bit. What about cases of Pol Pot, who killed 1 million out of 3 million Khmer in Cambodia? Never faced justice. Never happened. He died of natural causes. What about Hitler? Killed 6 million Jews and gypsies and Catholics and homosexuals and people with handicaps and killed 6 million, and he shot himself before he was ever brought to trial. What about Joseph Stalin, who died in his bed, killing somewhere between, the historians put it, 20 and 50 million people in the Russian gulags? How do you defeat evil? They were never brought to justice. Even if they were, what would the justice be? Oh, so you serve 20 years in jail and maybe face capital punishment? That's supposed to explain all these horrors that happened out here? No, under naturalism, you can't defeat evil. And finally, you can't deal with evil. For some reason, atheists really are upset about the problem of evil and suffering. And yet, it seems to me that they don't realize that the alternative is far, far worse. By denying God, you don't get rid of evil. You don't get rid of the problem. You just make the problem more absurd, more deranged, more hopeless, more despairing, and less emotionally satisfying. I remember sitting around a fire with a young agnostic student where he was talking about friends of his who had died literally in his arms of drug overdoses. And he said, when that happened, I remember seeing my friend, just imagine your best friend dying in your arms of a drug overdose. And he said, after that happened, I just couldn't believe in God. And I was at one of those moments where, I don't know if you've had this happen, where you just feel like a frog entered your throat and you're like, what do I say to that? And there was this young woman, 18 years old, who was sitting next to me around the fire, and she turned to him and she asked him, hey, so-and-so, how has rejecting God helped you deal with your suffering? And he burst into tears. He said, it hasn't. How could it? By getting rid of God, we're getting rid of hope. So we don't have the problem of evil, of having a good God and having evil in the world, but it's kind of like saying, I'm going to get rid of my cancer by burning myself alive. I'm killing the cancer, but I'm killing myself in the process. So this is difficult for everyone. Also, the problem of evil, in many ways, is one of the better arguments for, now catch this, for the existence of God. You're like, how are you going to pull this one off here? Well, this is what's referred to as the moral argument for God. If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values do exist. Therefore, three, God exists. That's the moral argument. Now, guess what is an objective moral value? That we shouldn't torture little babies for fun. That we shouldn't hurt people without a just cause. That we shouldn't murder. That we shouldn't. These are all objective moral values. So by saying that there's such a thing as evil in the world, what you're saying is that there's a standard of good against which you're comparing evil. Here's the way Ravi Zacharias put it. He said, when you say that there is evil, aren't you admitting that there is good? Yes. When you accept the existence of goodness, you must affirm a moral law on the basis of which to differentiate between good and evil. Good point. You might have these moral values floating out there in the stratosphere, honesty, love, altruism, but then you got these other values out there, selfishness, egoism. And so you got the values, but now you're like, which ones are good and which ones are evil? Well, you'll need a moral law to say that's good, that's evil. He says, but when you admit a moral law, you must posit a moral law giver. How do we have laws without lawgivers? That's like going to the pharmacist and saying, I've got a prescription. And he says, well, there's no signature. Who is the prescriber? Well, there is no prescriber. It's just a prescription. That's a nonsense statement. A moral law without a moral lawgiver. So Ravi Zacharias says, that, however, is who you are trying to disprove and not prove. For if there is no moral lawgiver, then there is no moral law. Very well written, very well said, in fact. So people saying, I can't believe in God because of all the evil in the world, you have to ask, well, how do we even define evil if there is no God? If they're saying, well, evil is just a subjective feeling that I have, like when I see something horrible happen, an atrocity, that I just don't like that. Well, are you saying it's actually objectively evil or you just don't like it? No, not objectively, like an objective moral law. I just don't personally like it. Then what are you saying? You're basically saying the problem of evil is like the problem of broccoli. What's the problem? I just really don't like it. Why would God put that in the world? Broccoli. I don't like the color. I don't like the smell. I don't like the taste, texture. Well, that's a subjective opinion. But when you say that there's too much evil in the world, we know what you mean. You mean it in the objective sense. Because that's the only way that makes this an incoherency with theism. A subjective problem of evil doesn't raise any difficulty with theism. Any more than a subjective problem with broccoli would be a problem for theism. Number three, we would argue that the statements God exists and evil exists are not inherently contradictory. Like if I said this man is a bachelor and this same man is married at the same time in the same place in the same way, law of non-contradiction, then that would be inherently illogical, right? That's just not even possible. But what's the logic? Why? Because A can not be non-A. But what's the logical contradiction of God exists and evil exists? You see how those are two different statements? Married bachelor, that's not the same. Dry slipperiness, that's not the same. But God exists and evil exists. What's contradictory about that? Here's one of the oldest formulations that I know of. This is from Epicurus. Maybe you've heard of Epicurean philosophy. Acts 17, where Paul talked to the Epicureans from Epicurus. He said, is God willing to prevent evil, but not able? Like, does he want to really stop that evil thing from happening? But he can't. Well, then he's not omnipotent. He's not all powerful. He wants to do it, but he can't. Is he able, but not willing? Like, he could stop that evil atrocity from happening. He just doesn't want to. Well, then he's malevolent. He's evil. He's not omnibenevolent. He's not all loving. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? So this is referred to as the omni-triad. How can we have all three at once? Well, it's interesting. Since 1977, in Anglo-American philosophy, this argument against God, this is referred to as the deductive problem of evil. This argument against God has been solved in philosophy. So much for the idea where people say, oh, philosophy never solves anything. Yes, it has. Since 1977, in Alvin Plantinga's book, God, Freedom, and Evil, Alvin Plantinga was a philosopher at Notre Dame and then at a reformed college of some kind, I can't remember. He's the philosopher whom William Lane Craig says is the greatest living philosopher on planet Earth. Okay, so if you get that kind of praise from William Lane Craig, that says quite a bit. Alvin Plantinga wrote this short little book in 1977, which, by the way, is the same year that Star Wars Episode IV came out, in case you were wondering. And he wrote this book, and after that book was published, there were critiques of it that fell flat. One of which was by J.L. Mackey in his 1982 book, I believe, The Miracle of Theism. He's an atheist. And Mackey was famous for the deductive problem of evil. God exists and evil exists. That's a logical contradiction. It's impossible. Impossible for God and evil to exist. And in 1982, he wrote The Miracle of Theism, and he still stuck to his guns on that. It's impossible for God and evil to coexist. Well, the problem for Mackey is that Anglo-American philosophy had completely shifted since Alvin Plantinga. And people started to realize that there is no deductive problem of evil. Let me give you some examples. We're going to do a couple of deductive arguments. Remember we said in deductive argumentation that if it's a valid construction, meaning that it's logically valid, that the premises lead to the conclusion, and each premise is true, or more plausibly true than not, then it's called a sound argument. So all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Good. That's very good. So that's a valid argument. The premises lead to the conclusion. It's also a sound argument. All men are mortal. That's true. Well, I guess not Jesus. Well, he did die. But anyways, all men are mortal. Yeah. Socrates was a man. Yeah. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Yeah. Now, what if I said, all men are mortal. Fido, my dog, is a man. Therefore, Fido is mortal. Now, would it be a valid argument? Yeah, it would. It's just not a sound argument because it turns out premise two is false. Fido isn't a man, he's a dog. It's even an argument that has a true conclusion. Fido, a dog, is mortal. It just isn't logically valid or sound. Does that make sense? So in deductive arguments, let me argue this with you. Let me point this out. You don't want to argue against the conclusion. Because if the premises are true, the conclusion is true. Instead, what you want to do is point out one of the premises that is false. Let's look at this one here. Formulation number one, deductive problem of evil. Premise one, God is the author of everything. Premise two, evil is something. Therefore three, God is the author of evil. Now, I've already told you, you don't want to say that premise three, the conclusion, I guess, is wrong, because it follows necessarily from premise one and two. So between premise one and two, which one do you think is false? One of those premises has to be false. Which one do you think it is? Yeah. What's that? Why do you say that? I see what you're saying. Maybe you could really narrow in on the semantics of author. What does it mean that he authors everything? Creates it, superintends it, allows it to exist, sustains it. I'm really narrowing in on number two. Oh man, I think we can rip this one apart. We can smash this, destroy it, annihilate it, make it go home crying to its mother. Premise two is never going to be the same again in the next 5 minutes. Evil is something. Evil is not a thing. It is the distortion of a thing. What Augustine in the 4th century, he said, evil is the privation of something that is good. In order to have evil, it needs to be the distortion or a parasite on a good host. In other words, you can't have a parasite without a host, and you can't have evil without something that's good. And so when we look at every example of evil in the world, we can say, no, that's not evil in and of itself. It's only evil because it's sucking off of something that's good. So when we say that someone who has, a disease, when we say that that's evil, we're saying that's evil because we're presupposing the goodness of being healthy. Think of it like this. If you had a car and it was rusted, we would say that's bad, bad for the car, because rust for cars is bad. But could you have a car that's completely rusted? No, that would be called a brown spot on the pavement. That's no longer a car, right? If you had a garment, a piece of clothing hung up in the closet and it was eaten by moths, you know, there's holes, you know, you would say, okay, that's bad. But what if it was completely eaten by moths? What would you call that? Would you call it a moth-eaten shirt? No, you'd call it a hanger, right? Because there's nothing there. And the same thing is true with saying evil is a thing. Evil is the distortion of a thing. Does that make sense? The privation of a thing. All right, deductive problem formulation number two. Premise one. If God is all good, he would destroy evil. Premise two. If God is all powerful, he could destroy evil. Premise three, evil is not destroyed. Therefore, four, there is no such God. Now, why don't you take a couple minutes at your tables and just think through which of the premises you would want to challenge. Again, don't pick number four, because these are all valid arguments. If one, two, and three are true, four follows. So don't pick four. But one, two, and three, which one would you go after? All right, so, given you some time, which premise would you go after? Premise one, two, or three? Yes? Three? But evil is not destroyed. Okay, how would you say that that's false? Because it seems to me that evil does exist.
It does exist, but they
do. Very good. Okay, evil is not destroyed currently. Yeah, but it could be destroyed in the future. Good. I didn't pick that one personally, but yeah. Good. How do we know what God would do? Good. Any other thoughts? Maybe one more point you would want to make here. I would go after either premise one or premise two. Here's why. If God is all good, he would destroy evil. Well, who performs evil? Humans. Mostly. There's fallen angels who have free will, but mostly humans. And it is logically impossible to force a free-willed agent to do good. So, it could be the case that God could, well, if God is all good, he would destroy evil. If God is all powerful, he could destroy evil. But the problem is that in destroying evil, he would destroy us as well. And that might not be a cost that God is willing to pay. So it's the difference between not just destroying evil, which God could do with a puff of his mouth. It's defeating evil. How does he ultimately defeat evil in the world? And it seems to me, and Plantinga argues as well, that there are many times where we see examples of good people, good agents who permit suffering. I always give the example of my son, who I take in to get the immunization shots. I'm actually holding him down so the doctor can puncture his skin with a piece of metal and squirt this virus into his body. What kind of a cruel, evil father are you? It's because I'm permitting that temporary pain to protect him, ultimately. And the same thing is true here, only to an infinite degree, literally, a progressively infinite degree, that God has a plan to bring about the maximum number of people to come to Christ and then to live in heaven with him forever and to never rebel ever again. So if that's his plan, permitting short-term evil would actually result in a justified, morally justifiable good. One thing I would add on to Emma's point there is, for premise three, you could actually reformulate this argument into what is called the eschatological response to the problem of evil. Remember, we studied eschatology, the end of history. We can actually turn this argument on its head. If God is all good, he would destroy evil. We affirm that. If God is all powerful, he could destroy evil. But evil is not yet destroyed. So therefore, God will destroy evil. You like that? It's actually an argument that God is going to return and is going to destroy evil, but he's waiting. Why would he wait? Why would he permit a world filled with evil and suffering? It must be because he has some kind of morally incomprehensible, justifiable reason. Something on the order of 2 Peter 3:9, that God does not wish any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. That God is waiting for many, many, many people to find eternal life forever. This free will defense is what Plantinga argued. It is not popular in Reformed circles, Calvinistic circles. Why not? Because they don't believe in free will. The closest they come to it is called a compatibilist free will. And yet, Plantinga argues that what you need for this argument to go through is called a libertarian free will. The real choice. Or the real will in order to choose. All right, let's look at deductive problem number three. Premise one, God made everything perfect. Premise two, imperfection cannot come from perfection. Premise three, perfectly created beings cannot be the origin of evil. Therefore, four, God must be the origin. Now look at that and see what you can come up with. Which of these would you argue against? All right, what do you guys got? Yeah. Good. I agree. Three. Through and through. Perfectly created beings cannot be the origin. I was trying to think of a good illustration for this. Basically what we're trying to get at, God could create a perfectly created, free-willed agent. They're perfectly created, no evil whatsoever, not the smallest modicum of evil. And yet, because they have free will, they could freely choose to do evil. And so this just wouldn't follow. Well, I would go after two or three. God created perfect beings with free will. That's the point. Imperfection cannot come from perfection. This is almost describing reality like a computer program or something. What we're describing here is that God did make everything perfect. Yes, imperfection cannot come from perfection unless that being is a free-willed agent, and that's exactly what we're arguing for. And so Plantinga made this case and just showed one formulation after another that it's not possible. Now his opponent said, well, what about natural evil? Natural evil. Like, you know, what about like tornadoes and floods and viruses? And you know what Plantinga came back and said? Demons. And people just thought, oh my gosh, the most brilliant Christian philosopher on the planet says demons are the problem of tornadoes and so forth. And Plantinga said, oh, no, no, no. That's not what I believe. I don't think that demons are responsible for all sickness and all tornadoes and all tsunamis and all. He said, I'm just saying it's possible. And he landed his point because basically the atheist is saying it's impossible for God and suffering to exist. And Plantinga says, well, what about if it was demons that did it? And they said, you believe in demons? He says, well, no, I'm just saying for the sake of argument. What if there were free-willed agents that had libertine free will, or libertine, that's kind of funny, libertarian free will is what I meant to say, and demons caused it. And they're like, yeah, but you don't believe that there are demons that do all the evil. He's like, it doesn't matter. I'm showing it's possible. And if it's even possible, then it shows that your argument doesn't follow. Isn't that wild? So that book came out in what year? 1977. 1979, William Rowe, atheistic philosopher at Purdue, writes, some philosophers have contended that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God. No one, I think, has succeeded in establishing such an extravagant claim. Michael Martin, atheistic philosopher at Boston University. When did Plantinga come out? 1977. Michael Martin, writing in 1978, writes this. He says, it is generally agreed that the following statements are logically compatible. One, God is all powerful. Two, God is all good. Three, evil exists in great abundance. Paul Draper, 1989, atheistic philosopher at Purdue. I agree with most philosophers of religion that theists face no serious logical problem of evil. That God exists and evil exists. There is no logical contradiction. That's the deductive problem of evil. What about the inductive problem of evil? You're like, what's that? Well, it isn't saying that we're showing that it's impossible for these two to exist. We're just saying that it's really unlikely. Like, here's a deductive argument. Premise one. Everyone who lives in Northern Ireland is Protestant. Premise two. Flannery lives in Northern Ireland. Conclusion three, Flannery is Protestant. That's a deductive argument. If one and two are true, three is certain. Here's an inductive argument, a little bit different. Premise one, 70% of people who live in Northern Ireland are Protestant. Premise two, Flannery lives in Northern Ireland. Therefore three, Flannery is Protestant. Is that a good deductive argument? No, it's a really good inductive argument. Because you're saying it's more probable than not that if 70% are Protestant and Flannery's there, then he's probably a Protestant. And so they argue it's not that it's impossible, it's just really, really, really unlikely. The problem with this is that the atheist shoulders an incredible burden of proof here. Because remember, they're the ones making the argument against the theist. So it's not our job to defend our view, it's our job to defeat their view. They're saying God doesn't exist. Oh, that's a thought. How do you know? Well, because it's really improbable, with all the evil in the world, that an omnibenevolent and omnipotent being would exist. And you're saying probabilities. Okay, I studied those, like things are probable or improbable. How do you know? Like, in order to say that it's improbable to win the lottery, I need to know how many balls are in that big thing that gets turned around, and how many numbers are on each ball, and how many people are in the country. That would show me probability. But how could you possibly know what's probable or improbable with regard to God permitting evil? All probabilities are relative to the background information. What if I told you that 90% of college students drink beer? Premise one. Premise two, Joe is a college student. Therefore three, Joe drinks beer. Now would that be a good inductive argument? Oh yeah, 90%, that's real good. Now what if I told you some background information about Joe? Joe goes to Brigham Young University. A university founded by the LDS Church, where 90% of students at Brigham Young University don't drink beer. And Joe goes to Brigham Young. Now what does the probability tell you? Actually, just the opposite. And the same thing is true here. If you're just saying, I think it's really improbable that God, an all-loving and all-powerful God, would exist and evil would exist, okay, we could debate that. But what about all the background information that we have with regard to the biblical account? We're going to argue that the biblical worldview offers the best logical and emotional answers to the problem of evil. So if you're just looking at theism, the existence of God, that's one thing. As Richard Swinburne, the Oxford philosopher, calls it the bare theism, B-A-R-E, bare theism. That's one thing. But we're talking about Christian theism. And with Christian theism, you have a number of different parts of the narrative, the story, that God created beings with free will, that there is a supernatural realm filled with spiritual beings, angels, demons, and that there is a story of redemption, of God paying the ultimate price at the cross, of eternal life in the future. And you start to pile all of this background information up. It's just like saying, all college students drink beer. Wait, all college students at Brigham Young don't drink beer. And the probability shifts in the other direction. And so let's give some of the answers that are the best logical and emotional answers of the biblical worldview. For one, free will. Free will. This is something which is arguably one of the most well-taught aspects in the Bible. From beginning to end, we see that people are endowed, are given libertarian freedom, that they're able to choose. Now, has this been lost to a large degree because of the fall? Are we affected by sin? Are we slaves of sin? Yes, 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 and yes. And is it true that we always have free choice? No. I might have the free will to escape prison, but I don't have the free choice to do so. I might have the free will to speak Latin, but I don't have the free choice to do so because I never studied it. I might have the free will to bench press a car, but I don't have the free choice to do that. So free will is a will, a desiring of the will, the volition to do something. And the Bible teaches that we have a significant level of free will. It's interesting that most secular people really value freedom. You don't see any marches that say, down with freedom, or please control me. Everyone's always saying, oh, you got to get your, you know, morality off of me, get your laws off my body and everything else. And they're basically saying freedom is a good thing, to have freedom of the will and not to be controlled, that to have some kind of an oligarchy or some kind of a higher governmental structure coming in to control your life would be a bad thing. And yet when it comes to God, an omnibenevolent, all good God, all of a sudden they say, well, we don't think free will is that great after all. When we say we don't want free will, what are we asking for? What's the alternative? Some people would say, well, we could have free will, and yet at the same time, maybe we just couldn't affect other people. I like to think of this as like the bubble boy theory. That's the theory where we're all in a bubble and we can't actually interact or touch or hurt other people. So I have free will in my bubble and you have free will in your bubble, but we just can't hurt each other. Well, we could talk to each other, which means we could cuss each other out and that would hurt each other's feelings. Okay, our bubbles are soundproof. Okay. But you could still see each other. But see, if you could see each other, you could like use inappropriate gestures and you could make faces. And, okay, so our bubbles, they're opaque. You can't see through them. But maybe we could like, kind of like touch hands through the bubble. But see, if we touched hands through the bubble, then I might be able to hit you through the bubble and then that would hurt you. So basically the bubbles are separated. So basically what are we describing? If we're saying we have free will, but we can't interact with other free will agents, we're describing solitary confinement, one of the worst punishments you could endure. I remember watching one of those cop shows. It was the one that opens up with dun 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 dun. Which one is that?
Yeah.
Dun dun.
The Law and Order.
Law and Order. That's it. Yeah, Law and Order. And the one tough cop, he was trying to experience. Look how I do two notes and they're the same one. Dun dun. And you're like Law and Order. One of the really tough cops. He says, "Hey, I want you to treat me like I was a criminal." He says, okay. He says, so put me in solitary. The guard says, okay, sure. So he gets thrown in solitary and he says, now listen, I just want you to put me in there for 24 hours, no longer. Understand? Guy, oh, is it? He says, I want you to put me in there for 72 hours and no longer. And so the guy's like, all right, you know, sure. So he says, but treat me like a criminal, sure. So he goes into the solitary confinement and he's doing push-ups and sit-ups and he's, you know, trying to keep himself sane. And they open up the little, you know, drawer and they shove his food through and he says, hey, how you doing out there? And they shut it real quick, just like they would with a prisoner. And sure, on and on it goes until finally his time's up and they open up the door and this guy, this cop comes bursting through the door and he grabs the guy by the lapel, ready to knock him out. And he says, yeah, you idiot, I told you 72 hours, you had me in there forever. And he said, detective, I had you in there for 72 hours. And it was basically showing the insanity that you go through when you're locked up and you're in a box. Is that what we're asking for? Is that a better world? Is that really what we're saying? What about this idea that you're basically free-willed agent and yet you're forced to do something? This would be the view of Clockwork Orange, where the social deviant, the main character in the book and in the movie, they basically brainwash him to hate doing evil and only doing good. So we're going to basically force someone to freely choose something. See, that's, first of all, this is a disgusting picture. And second of all, that's a contradiction. You can't force someone to freely choose something. We could do like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where we perform a lobotomy on humans, and so they really don't have rationality in able or being able to perform moral actions, because rationality is necessary, though not sufficient, to have morality. And so if we just took out a little bit of the prefrontal cortex, we would basically lower humanity so they wouldn't be immoral, and therefore we wouldn't hurt each other. We'd have free will, but we just really wouldn't be moral agents. But see, by taking away freedom, I guess is what I'm arguing, in each one of these cases, whether taking away the structure of the brain, whether taking away a person's freedom through brainwashing, whether taking away their freedom by limiting their choice so much so that they're basically in solitary confinement, by taking that away, you're taking away their humanity. And you're insulating them. True. You're insulating them from evil and suffering and pain. But you're also insulating them from things that are good and happy and joyous. And so this would be part and parcel with the overprotective parent that never lets their kid leave their room their whole life. Well, they're definitely going to protect their kid from evil and suffering and getting picked on, and sure, but they're also going to be keeping them from a bunch of incredible experiences. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but it just doesn't even compare, because the evil and suffering in the world, I mean, we're talking about some of the most grotesque things a person can even comprehend. However, I would argue, on the other side, it's not just being insulated from evil, it's also being insulated from good. And what good is it? A maximally great good, eternal life. So God is allowing us to have significant freedom to experience suffering, pain, and death, so that we can have freedom to do what? To make the decision to come to Christ and to have eternal life forever. And that would be an ultimate good. There could be no greater good than that. If we're saying that we want God to create a free-willed agent whom he controls, he can't do that. That's like asking God to create a square circle, or a world where 2 + 2 = 5, or a married bachelor, or a world in which he himself doesn't exist, or a stone so heavy that he can't move it, or a free person whom he controls. Those are all logical contradictions. So, in the biblical worldview, we believe that there's free will, and taking this away would take away a significant, incredible opportunity to get eternal life. In a sense, what we're saying is God wanted minds, not machines. To have a machine is different than having a mind. When I was in grade school, they first came out with that technology that you could type a sentence into the computer and then the computer would read it back to you. So as grade school kids, we would type in all sorts of terrible, ugly, profane things into the computer, and the computer would be like, Mrs. Smith, you are one ugly, you know, whatever, and it would just like read off this whole thing. It was just really evil and wicked thing to do as a little kid. But that's what we would do. Okay, so now imagine I'm sitting at home with my computer and I type in, Papa, I love you, and I hit enter, and it says, and it's, you know, robot voice, Papa, I love you. That's a machine telling me it loves me. It just, I don't know, it just doesn't, what is that? Programming it to love me. But to have your kid crawl up on your lap and kiss you on the cheek and say, Dada, I love you. That's a different kind of relationship, is what we're arguing for. I don't know if you saw the movie Her by Spike Jonze. Basically, the whole premise is Joaquin Phoenix is in love with his iOS program, Scarlett Johansson. And he's really in love with her. And then until you reach the end of the movie where he realizes, wait a minute, you love all of the people with this program on their phones? And she's like, yeah, like millions of people. And he's like, I thought we had something special. You realize you're in love with a machine. It's not real. It's fake. When it comes to free will, people say, well, God gave us free will, and then we use free will to hurt people, and so really hurting people is God's fault because he's up the causal chain. Really? Let me ask you a question. Who's responsible for this? A guy drinks 12 shots of Jim Beam, gets behind the car, and wraps the car around a telephone pole? Who's responsible for that? The drunk driver or Ford Motor Company? Well, if Ford never made that car, then he never would have gotten that car, and then he never would have wrapped that car around a telephone pole and hurt people. Ford Motor Company is up the causal chain, but they're not responsible for what he did with that car. Let me put this a different way. When it comes to things like free will, the user is guilty, not the giver. Think of it like this. An axe really is morally neutral. You could use an axe to chop down a tree to heat your house, or you could use an axe to split someone's head open. It's the user of the axe that's guilty, not the giver of the axe. You could use a pen to write a sonnet or use a pen to write slander. Well, what about a mind? Somebody with a really intelligent mind. Well, they could use that intelligence to cure cancer, or they could use it to rob a bank. Oh, we got to get rid of intelligent people. We should just kill them all off. Oh, we got to get rid of pens, man. Let's just get rid of pens. We got to get rid of axes. No more axes anymore. Now, I think you can see that these are morally neutral faculties. Intelligence, pens, these are not the giver, it's the user of them. And the same is true with free will. If our decisions are truly free, then the buck stops there with regard to guilt or responsibility. What about natural evil? I already alluded to this. What about examples of tornadoes, disease, and so forth, which can't be traced back to a free moral agent? This isn't like murder or assault or something like that. This is just something where nature comes through and a flood kills off several thousand people. What about that? How does that fit in with this free will defense? How do we explain natural evil rather than moral evil? Some apologists have argued that these different aspects of nature actually aren't evil because they serve as a necessary prerequisite for life. So, for example, if we didn't have floods, we wouldn't have silt and minerals to farm. If we didn't have all the tornadoes, all the tsunamis, for example, why do we have those? Well, because we have the sun, which heats the equator, and then the different poles are very cold, and then what you have is a clashing of heat pockets and cold pockets together, which forms tornadoes and tsunamis and everything else, and so that's really evil. But, so we could fix that if we just had three suns. If you had a sun that went around the equator and then two suns on each pole, you would have an equal heat distribution, and so you wouldn't have tornadoes. The problem is, if you had three suns, you would completely melt the earth of life. Some argue in this respect, I think there's something to that. And yet, it always makes me wonder, couldn't God have created a world where we didn't need that? It always pushes it back a step. Couldn't God have created a world where there weren't a necessity for three suns or two, but just a world where everything was perfectly heated or cooled? I would prefer a different approach, which is that God created a world with the uniformity of cause and effect, where there are laws, natural laws of physics and chemistry. And the first humans, when they morally violated what God had given to them and went out on their own, what they were doing, in a sense, was hurling themselves into a world of cause and effect. What they were doing is saying, with our free will, we want to give up our protection by you, God, and we want to go out on our own. So, when it comes to humans going through free will, where did that come from? It came from the first humans deciding to misuse their free will and to be thrown into a world of cause and effect. Now, I don't know in the original state that humans were in. I don't know if when they were on Earth in a world of cause and effect, if they were just impervious to any kind of death. I don't know if the tree of life means something very specific in the sense of it gives you life and you can't die. Like if you fell off a cliff, you would just bounce right back up. I don't know if that's what it means. Or could it be that God created the Garden of Eden, the garden in Eden, and he created it like a biosphere where outside of it you had, you know, animal predation and evil and tornadoes, but inside the garden it was protected. Which is it? I don't know. All I know is when they decided to throw off God's leadership, they threw themselves out of that protection, away from the tree of life, away from the garden, and consequently, all the natural evil we experience came from the first humans. And so this would go back to that argument that if you're trapped in a bubble, you can't hurt anybody, and yet you will hurt yourself. And in order to have true personhood, we need to be able to interact with other people. Some natural evil could be the result of demonic activity. We don't know. At least we know in the Bible, both the Old and New Testament, with Jesus' string of healing miracles, especially in the Gospel of Mark, and then the book of Job, we see that both moral evil, the Sabaeans come and attack Job's family and his workers, that's moral evil, and natural evil, where a fire came down from heaven, the roof collapsed and killed his kids, both are attributed to Satan. Jesus' miracles, sometimes he helps out someone who is hurting and sick, and we realize that the author tells us it was because of a demon. Now, this is different than saying that all natural evil is demonic. Every time there is a flood, every time there's a hurricane, every time there's a lightning storm, that was Satan. That's different. We're saying that some could be the result of demonic activity, and we're basing that on Scripture itself. We could also point out that free will amplifies natural evil. Oh, I saw the sickening news when there was the hurricane down in, or the earthquake down in Haiti. And everyone around the world was just emptying their pockets to bring food and clothes and clean water down to these poor people who were just trying to pull themselves out of the dirt. You know, thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands killed. And they brought all these goods, and immediately the Haitian gangs and the Haitian government got a hold of it, collected all of these generous goods, and then started selling it to the people at upraised prices. And I thought to myself, here we go. People saying, oh, it's all the natural evil, what about that? And God saying, actually, I was going to provide for those people. And people amplified it. There was a woman who asked her pastor, she said, why doesn't God feed the people in the third world? You know, why doesn't he provide the food for them? And he responded, he said, God did provide the food. The problem is you ate it. There's plenty of food to go around. The problem is we're not sharing it with each other. And so very frequently we get these very, very unrighteous indignation of God, and why won't he do this? Why won't he do that? And honestly, at the center of it, we see a mirror that's reflecting back on ourselves, that we're not there to help. According to Jesus, when he was addressing the problem of evil in Luke chapter 13, he said that Pilate mixed the blood of the Gentiles and the Galileans, moral evil. And also the Tower of Siloam fell on these people. I can't remember how many. The tower just like one day was like up, and then one day it lost structural integrity and fell and killed a bunch of people. What was Jesus' response to the moral evil of Pilate and the natural evil of the tower falling over? His response was identical. He said, do you think that you're more righteous than them? Those people who were killed by Pilate. Truly I say to you, no, but unless you too repent, you will not see the kingdom of God. And what about those who died in the tower? You think you're more righteous than them? Unless you repent, you will not see the kingdom of God. And so what's Jesus' point? His point is towers fall over. His point is dictators kill. And when we're in the middle of a world of insanity and evil and suffering, what's the takeaway? What are we supposed to do? Jesus says, don't think about this life. Think about the next life. Turn to God. Time is short. A tower could fall on you at any moment. A killer could take your life at any second. And this is supposed to show us that our time is short and there is a high urgency to meet Christ. Perhaps in a world infused with suffering that God has permitted, that is exactly the kind of world where people come to Christ the most. Think about that. In fact, when we think about the idea of finitude, our own finitude, when we're trying to make a probability estimate, when we're trying to say, well, I don't think that's very probable that God would allow this or that, how could you possibly know that? As I said, this world could be precisely the world where the most number of people come to meet Christ. Think of Mao's Cultural Revolution, which killed off 20 million Chinese. There are reports that are so gruesome. Private parts being burned with acid, both men and women. There were times where people wouldn't walk by the sidewalks of the skyscrapers because suicide was so high from Mao's reign that people were jumping off and killing themselves and others in the process. That's how horrible this was. Killed 20 million people. Now we look back and we see that after this cultural revolution, 30,000 people today came to Christ in China. China has gone from no Christians to somewhere between 130 and 150 million Christians. Now, did God cause Mao there? No, he didn't cause it. Did he cause the evil? No, he didn't cause it. But he permitted it. Why? Maybe because that's precisely the condition where you would have hundreds of millions of people coming to meet Christ. We see this right down the line. El Salvador, 12-year civil war, earthquakes, poverty. They went from 2% Christian to 20% Christian in 30 years. Ethiopia, horrific. Oppression, famine, poverty. They went from 0.8% Christian to 13% Christian in 30 years. So, in other words, what we're saying here is, when you say, well, I just don't think that's possible that God would allow that much evil, how could you possibly know that? That's like the book by Ray Bradbury, The Sound of Thunder, where Eccles goes into the past and he's trying to hunt dinosaur and he accidentally steps on a butterfly. And then he comes back to the present and he finds out that a communist has taken over and the world is, you know, being ruined. And why did that happen? Because he stepped on a butterfly. A totally insignificant thing which had a butterfly effect, you might say. Just something so minute, so small, that it actually affected the entire future history. So for someone to say, I don't know why God would allow that right there. Why would he allow that? How could you possibly know how this event could impact the next 10, 20 years, let alone eternity into the future? We're too finite to know. In fact, in order to know if God is morally justifiable, we would need to be God. Because only an omniscient mind would be able to know that, kind of a probability. And yet that's the very being we're trying to disprove. Number three, when we think about forever, eternity, the biblical account says evil came from humans. We're too finite to know why God would permit evil. And at the same time, God says that I'm working all this for eternity, for forever. How much does my, let's say, 80 years of suffering compare with eternity? How much does 80 years compare to 800 years? How much does 80 years compare to 8,000 years? How much does it compare to 80,000 years? 8 million years in heaven, in paradise forever. Mother Teresa, a woman who suffered intensely, said that my whole life could be compared to one night in an unpleasant hotel compared to heaven. So when we're saying there's no way God could have a justifiable purpose for all this, first of all, how do you know that? And second of all, how could you even compare that with regard to eternity? And then finally, the biblical worldview offers us Christ, offers forgiveness. So free will, finitude, forever, and forgiveness. This is what's most amazing. R.C. Sproul was once asked, well, how could God allow an innocent person to suffer? And R.C. Sproul said, I've never met an innocent person, so I can't answer that question. He said, the only innocent person who's ever lived was Jesus of Nazareth, and we killed him, and we put him up on the cross and tortured him, And yet he's the same person who's reaching out his hand and offering us forgiveness. One thing we can always bank on is to picture ourselves at the foot of the cross, to see the free will of the religious and political authorities, to see the free will of the soldiers attacking Jesus, stabbing him, lashing him, whipping him. And then to look over and to see the women at the foot of the cross and to be thinking, how could God allow this? The one innocent man who's ever lived is suffering in the worst horrific way possible. There's no way he could allow that. No way. I mean, he could allow the Tower of Siloam falling over or Pilate, but to allow Jesus to be crucified and killed, no way. And yet it was the very free will of these evil people, and it was the finitude of these women who couldn't see 3 days later into the future, for they couldn't see that Christ was actually opening up forever. He was opening up eternity, and he was offering forgiveness. So in fact, the worst conceivable act of evil on earth that's ever happened, in God's hands, produced the greatest conceivable good. So anytime we look at an event and we say there's no way God could bring anything good out of that, we have to go back and say God did that through the cross. John Lennox is famous for saying, you know, I don't have all the answers for the problem of evil, but I do believe that God entered our world through the cross and was hung naked on the cross. And I have to ask myself the question, if God was really up on that cross, what was he doing there? And from that he infers, if God is willing not only to suffer with us, but suffer for us, that's the kind of God I can believe in.